It's the Trupany Show with your host, James Trupany.
Hello and welcome to the Trupany Show. My name is James Trupany and this is my show. And today we are with Beginner's Guide to Japanese Wrestling, episode 31, and we're moving into 1994. And our very first look at Japan Women's Project. And to join me to talk about this today is Mr. Alexander Watt. How are you, sir?
Hello, yes. Slightly tired and hungover, as we discussed off mic. I'm nothing if not professional, James. Let me tell you. I should also say I'm recording this in my kitchen, and there are quite loud roadworks outside. So if you hear drilling in the background, that's what that is. It's not weird stuff going on in my flat.
Well, we're used to kind of like natural disasters on the Trupany Show, what with Marcus living
that's
in Baton
true,
Rouge
yeah.
and the sirens outside in New York when Chelsea's online. And
yeah, well, you might hear sirens occasionally here because we live right in the centre of Manchester. So that maybe that'll happen. Who knows? Something to look forward to, potentially.
A societally stable place. I'm sure nothing bad ever happens there.
Yep.
Okay, the card we're looking at is the brilliantly titled Major Super Queen Flash! As an exclamation mark at the end. So I have to say that.
I love like the Joshi show names, the Japanglish,
yes.
You call it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just brilliant. It's just like, Giant Baba was also a big fan of these. That's the reason why it was like the Real World Tag League! Which doesn't make any sense. Like, the world isn't real.
The real world. This is the real world. None of that fake world that's over in America. Maybe
yes.
That was the idea.
I think that was basically it, yeah. It was decrying other wrestling for not being real. Of course, all wrestling is real. We know that now. So, JWP...
Japan it is, yeah.
So, JWP, we haven't looked at this company yet. We have mentioned it in passing. But JWP was an interesting company to start off with. It started really as a project kind of built around Jackie Sato, one of the beauty pair, who was a part of the 1970s tag team in All Japan Women, and she was chosen as head trainer. And it started off with a TV company wanting to start a new wrestling company. They got Fuji TV was their TV deal. So they got national television rights, and they wanted to produce a different kind of product to what All Japan Women was doing. But because there is Jackie Sato in charge of the dojo, you have a tendency to have stuff that's very similar to what you'd expect from All Japan Women. That's not to say that the roster wasn't very talented, and it obviously gave a lot of people more work and more opportunities. If you couldn't go into the AJW dojo, you might be able to get into the JWP dojo, which meant you had some different kinds of stars and some different kinds of people. Now, we're talking about 1990 to 1994, so there was obviously a big interest in Joshi at the time, thanks to the Crush Girls and the growth of Joshi throughout the 1980s. Alex, what did you think about JWP as a company before we get into the card, and where do you think their style developed from?
Well, this was interesting to me because in terms of like my classic Joshi knowledge from this era, the majority of the stuff I've seen is from All Japan Women rather than JWP. So it was interesting to watch a card from them. Obviously, the background, they were kind of always the number two promotion. They kept trying, is my understanding, they kept trying to close that gap. And I think sort of around 96, 97, it looked like they were getting close, and then there were a few issues, I think, with wrestlers retiring and getting injured and stuff like that kind of stopped them from ever reaching where AJW were. Like you say, there's some talent I haven't seen before on these shows, but there's also obviously there's like a lot of big names from the era that have crossed over, and we're obviously doing both shows, both promotions at the time, which it was just interesting to see a Joshi card that wasn't All Japan Women.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting because in 1994 the big Joshi companies JWP, LLPW, AJW and FMW were really cooking, so we're going to spend a lot of time talking about Joshi in this chapter of the Beginner's Guide to Pro Wrestling, because it was really
kind of the boom period, right?
It was, yeah.
this was literally when it was the best wrestling in the world was Joshi, basically.
Yeah, and that was, you know, at the time that was big talk because, you know, New Japan were on a big growth period. All Japan Pro Wrestling was on a big growth period as well. Mm. WWE.
Yeah, this was a great period for All Japan as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
It was pretty rad stuff going on in Japan in the early 90s, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument to say that WWE for most of 1994 and into 1995 weren't the biggest wrestling company in the world. They certainly weren't earning the most money. Certainly New Japan were probably getting more people to their events and All Japan were probably earning more money. And Joshi were probably just as big as the WWE was as far as ticket sales and penetration in the home market was concerned.
Mm, I think it's interesting in that sense as well, mentioning WWE, WWF at the time, like kind of putting into context when we're watching a card like this from sort of early mid 94. I mean, WWF at the time had only just sort of gone with your Shawn Michaels and your Bret Hart. They'd had Yokozuna as champ for ages. They tried to push Lex Luger, who was limited, shall we say. It was we'll go with that. But it's interesting when you watch these shows and put it in the context of what was going on in America at the time, and then you look at how innovative the stuff in Japan was, particularly like on this show. Some of the stuff is just nuts. It's like a decade ahead of its time. And yeah, over in WWF, they're just thinking, maybe we'll go with the two best wrestlers in the company. Maybe we'll give it a go.
Yeah, and also, you mean, you look at WWF, within 6 months of this card, a lot of the talent that was on this card were on WWF cards because they were trying to throw... They start their process of throwing things at the wall to see what sticks. They sign Medusa Miceli, who becomes Alundra Blaze. You know, they bring in Aja Kong, they bring in Bull Nakano, they bring in Kyoko Inoue. There is all sorts of talent that we will talk about today that end up in the WWF anyway, even though it didn't really stick. It was certainly something that they were toying with. They saw the attraction of what was going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's really interesting because later in the year, when Bull Nakano and Alundra Blaze were wrestling for the WWF women's title and stuff like that, it's I mean, they obviously had eyes on it and knew that there were big things happening.
Yeah, and we will be talking about the Big Egg Universe card from All Japan Women at some point within the next chapter, so within the next few weeks.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
But let's start off with this card, which started with your genuine Joshi opener of a tag match full of rookies wearing swimsuits, because that's what Joshi rookies wore at the time. And it was, well, actually, to be honest with you,
it's kind of like the young boys system in New Japan now, right, where they all kind of wear the same stuff because that's what you have to do.
Don't have to shave their heads though.
That's true.
You can take these things too far. I have been pleased to see that Marvelous have brought back the idea of rookies have to wear swimsuits, which is they are slightly more tailored and look like they fit properly now.
That's good of them, I'd yes. say. We should say as well, like, the video we've been watching this on was all over the place. Like, for whether, so, you know, if people are going to go and find it and watch it, everything's out of order. There's weird cuts and stuff in it along the way. Like, there's one later where Bull Nakano's going for the Poseidon's Trident and just it just cuts away.
Yeah,
just like, oh, I guess something happened there, but I don't know what it was.
I mean, the one advantage of this tape is you actually do see all the build up because all the promos and all the angles are in this particular tape, which you don't often see with
yes,
Japanese tapes.
That is good. Yeah.
That is good. So you get to see the background of what happened and why we got to this particular point. But having said that, you're right, it does chop and change. So we're talking in match order from the cage match listing, which makes it easier for us, but you will have to kind of like watch it. We found it at the Real Hero Archive, and you can watch it there. We'll link it up in the Twitter and the Facebook accounts should you wish to watch the card as well, which we kind of assume you do. otherwise, reviewing it for us is kind of like, well, it's fun for us. We want it to be fun for you as well. Okay, so the opening was a tag match, which was Fusaya Noki and Hiromu Yagi versus Kamuki Makawa and Rei Tamada. Now, this match was pretty cool for what it was, and it did what it said on the tin. It was rookies trying to get themselves over in a usual Joshi rookie style. It did actually look slightly harder hitting than the AJW rookies were at the time, which defies belief because the AJW rookies were going hell for leather anyway. And you're also going to get an idea of like the production values of this. It's really well shot. It's shot differently to AJW, actually. But one thing that does surprise me is the fact that I think it's shot on film, looking by the quality of it, rather than being shot on videotape, which meant they put some time into it. And it's kind of, even though it's like a fifth or sixth generation tape, at least it's kind of like still got the quality there to be able to visually see what's going on properly. So, yeah, this was good for what it was, and it kind of sets the tone for the card, really. You're going to see some good old-fashioned Joshi.
I was going to say, like, it's interesting you say it's more hard-hitting, which is, like you say, a bit of a surprise over the old the AJW rookies. But is it to do with, you know, like you said earlier, if they couldn't get in the AJW dojo, they could maybe get in this dojo, and then are they almost having to do more and prove themselves more that because they couldn't get in AJW? If that makes sense.
I think that's the kind of like the strong narrative, because if you look at Combat Toyota and Megumi Kudo with the obvious stars of FMW and the women there like Badness Nakamura and Shark Tikiso, they had to work really, really, really hard because they're not necessarily as physically talented as the wrestlers in AJW were, but they got over through storytelling and they got over through big bumps, and that's the reason why they were stars, if you see what I mean. And also those dangerous matches that they had to do with the barbed wire and the explosions. So, you know, JWP wasn't like that. There was some rough stuff in it, don't get me wrong, but it was more of a traditional Joshi company. But I certainly think that, you know, you're right. There is a kind of chip on the shoulder of the younger wrestlers in this particular show, isn't there?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we moved on to Bolshoi Kid versus Command Bolshoi, which is like this bizarre clown versus clown match.
great names, like, also just great names all over the card. Like, we spoke about them being obviously big wrestlers, but some of the names of Joshi wrestlers were just amazing, like Cutie Suzuki and Kandi Okutsu, Dynamite Kansei, obviously.
They did love
Devil,
their names.
Devil Masami.
Devil, like, Masami.
Yeah, there's no, you know what you're getting there, don't you? Like, she's a bad guy, if you didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, Bolshoi Kid and Command Bolshoi. I've been watching Bolshoi Kid, who doesn't wrestle anymore, but Command Bolshoi is still the lead booker of no longer JWP, because they had to close down last year thanks to a copyright dispute. After 34 years, someone decided that they didn't own the name anymore, so they had to become J Pure.
So ridiculous.
Yeah, so she's still the lead booker of J-Pure, and she's still a big draw for the company, and she still has abs like a cheese grater, and she still looks amazing. And in this match, she was still pretty amazing. It was a good aerial comedy match with what you kind of expect to see from two comedy clown wrestlers if you've seen either of them. And Command Bolshoi is such a brilliant, brilliant wrestler. Her ability to change gears from a high-flying comedy lucha act to a straight up and down shooter has always amazed me, because I kind of like always saw her in this kind of comedy role, and then one night she was wrestling for Sendai Girls and she went straight up shoot style, and it was like, whoa, this is interesting. She's a fascinating character and a fascinating wrestler as well. So I strongly suggest you find out some Command Bolshoi stuff, because it's really interesting to watch. The next match was Kandi Okutsu versus Kyoko Inoue. Now, Kyoko Inoue and Kandi Okutsu had kind of similar styles. This was a kind of interesting matchup. Pardon me. This was kind of an interesting matchup, and Okutsu did fare very well against Inoue, and I liked this match a lot. It was a lot of fun. But Inoue, as you know, is an acquired taste for me, and I think this is some of her best work, because I was seeing her wrestle somebody different, and therefore I found it more interesting, if you see what I mean. And Okutsu just doesn't give up through this entire match. She's just throwing fire at everything. So it's interesting to watch how this match developed. What do you think?
I loved that. There was a few examples of that throughout the card, of like basically one wrestler taking an absolute beating but just refusing to give up, which is very very much a trope of classic Joshi. But yeah, her fire and stuff was amazing. And it led to this great closing stretch where they were just hitting each other with everything and she was kicking out. The thing that actually struck me was this, you know, they had this great final few minutes, and then I thought the finish was actually a little bit anticlimactic, because she kicked out after Inoue hit her back elbow drop, and then so she kicked out and then immediately sort of tapped out to a sleeper, I think it was. That kind of struck me because it was like, oh, all right. I knew what they were going for. And sometimes that kind of finish works really well. It just felt a little bit anticlimactic here, but all the work leading up to it was amazing.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it was. I've seen Okutsu in support roles on a lot of AJW cards, and she certainly showed more here than what I've seen her doing other things, whereas she was in trios tag matches where she didn't really get the opportunity to showcase her wares, but she certainly did here. This was really good fun to watch.
Yeah, same. I've seen her in quite a lot of multi-woman matches where she's not the star in those matches. She's always with like the big names. So yeah, it was good to see her work in a singles match, what she could do there.
Yeah. And speaking of big names, Cutie Suzuki wrestled Takoko Inoue, and this was interesting because this is where they're trying to line up similar characters from the two different companies. Now obviously Takoko Inoue is an AJW wrestler, and Cutie Suzuki is a JWP wrestler, but they both have kind of a similar role within their respective companies. Takoko Inoue comes out to the Van Halen version of Pretty Woman, and Cutie Suzuki, given by her name and her ice dance outfit, it was kind of like considered kind of the cheesecake draw for JWP. One of the brilliant Carla Simano impersonations I saw in her closing run with Oz Academy was impersonating Cutie Suzuki one night, which was hilarious. And Cutie Suzuki was a hard worker. She kind of like has this reputation of being the cutesy pie wrestler, but having said that, she could go, and she had a real fire to her as a babyface. Brilliantly on the Dream Slam 1 card, she was partnered with Mayumi Ozaki, the queen heel of JWP, and it was Ozaki that was having to calm her down at the press conference, which is hilarious if you've seen any of Ozaki's stuff. What do you think of this, Alex?
Well, there's some Ozaki stuff coming up in a second, right?
So, oh, yeah. This is prime Ozaki stuff.
What you just said there about Cutie Suzuki sort of being like thought of in a certain way. I think I went in thinking of her in a certain way, and then it was like, God, these two are just beating the crap out of each other. Like, this isn't. She's not like a cutesy baby face, despite the name, and I'm sure she was in some of her other work, but like, the double stomp to the outside was just so brutal. Like, when you see Kenny Omega do stuff like that now, it's like, it's even more brutal than that. Like, she lays it in, and then. Yeah, it was just, again, like, back and forth, them just hitting these big, high-impact moves. There was, like, Inoue hit her with, like, a lariat from behind at one point, and I thought she'd actually, like, knocked her out because she hit her so hard with it. It was very much classic Joshi, like you say. And also, you mentioned the entrance themes. God, there were some great entrance themes on this card. Like, Aja Kong coming out to Judas Priest was the best one, I think, though.
Yeah. It's interesting watching this now. Like, WWE wouldn't present their women this way. So it's interesting to see, like, the WWE have kind of, like, taken a lot of what Joshi has on board with their presentation of women from the athletic perspective and from the storyline perspective and from the storytelling perspective. But you look at theme tunes and entrances, and they're also dead serious in Joshi. Like, Cutie Suzuki is this happy-go-lucky character that sells swimsuit calendars, but game face on, in a way, is in her way, and she won't stop until she's got past her, and that's the way it's going to work. And they hit each other so hard. Like you're saying, yeah, there's a double foot stomp, not from the top rope to the ring floor, but from the top rope to the floor. You know, it's like, even Kenny Omega didn't do that to Wrestle Kingdom. He did do that to Chris Jericho at Wrestle Kingdom, but he did it off the gantry, didn't he? So, you know.
And there was a table in the way.
There was a table in the way. Spread the weight a bit there and risk breaking your neck by sliding off of Chris Jericho. But, yeah, this was serious stuff.
Like, he laid it in, and then, like, a second later, they're both back in the ring because it's Joshi, and it's like, all right, yep. You just took that, okay.
None of this selling business. We haven't got time to sell things. We just keep going till we drop.
Basically,
I think it was in this match. I'm pretty sure it was. There was a spot that was very similar to the Omega Okada spot of last year where Omega just collapses in the middle of the Rainmaker, because I'm sure that in a way Lays goes to lay in a clothesline and Suzuki just crumples to the floor.
I can't remember off the top of my head, but very possibly. I know later in some of the matches they were doing stuff like that as well, and
yeah,
a lot of beating the crap out of one another, basically.
But yeah, I mean, Tsukoko in a way as well had a heavy reputation at the time. She wasn't in the upper echelon of AJW draws, but you can see why they picked her here for this. She was the prime candidate to have a good match with QT Suzuki, you know. And it's interesting to me how they match people up in cross promotion, like the series that Manami Toyota and Toshi Yamada had with Combat Toyota and Megumi Kudo was really interesting to me, because they were the equivalents of each other, the hard case and the scientist of both companies. And in this case, they're trying to match up the beauty pair of both companies, or the beauty kind of angle for both companies. Not that it has anything to do with the match, because the match is all about trying to top each other and trying to get the win at all costs. So it's interesting to see how that was developed. The next, we move on to a tag match, which featured the glorious, the wonderful, the mad mistress herself, Bull Nakano, tagging for the first time in what may have been many years, and in fact I'm not even sure if they'd ever tagged before, with Devil Masami. Now, Devil Masami was a graduate of the AJW dojo in the early 1980s and went on to be one of the main draws for JWP in the early 1990s. Me and Chelsea talked about their match on Dream Slam, match she had with Chigusa Nagayo on Dream Slam 1. And so these two each wrestled each other hundreds of times in 1981, 2 and 3. But this would be the first time, I'm sure, they tagged together, because Nakano was a face, believe it or not, back then. And they took on Hikaru Fukuoka and Seki Hasegawa, two wrestlers, one from JWP and one from AJW, who were known for their aggression. They were seen as kind of like the heirs apparent to Nakano and Devil Masami in their style, even though they were a lot smaller, but they were aggressive, straight-ahead wrestlers. And it's interesting here that we have a JWP and AJW partnership on both sides, rather than AJW versus JWP. I think they've realized at this point that, you know, you can have so many promotion versus promotion matches, but we've got to move beyond that. And this was certainly an interesting setup for that. What did you think of this, Alex?
Yeah, I agree on that. And I think it made more sense as what the teams were doing it that way, because you had the two slightly smaller wrestlers, but with loads of like fire and aggression against these two big monsters. Basically, the way they worked it was very classic, you know, babyface and heel kind of dynamic. Yeah, it was really good. Obviously, Bull Nakano is one of the best to ever do it, so she tends to have great matches. You know, you had sort of the trademark of the very rapid start with the drop kick attack from the other side, and then Devil Masami toss Fukuoka to the outside. Just brutal spots all the way through. Nunchucks got involved at one point.
Well, it's Bull Nakano, it has to happen.
Of course. Yeah. There was like a lot of creativity, and you know, Masami like military press slammed Fukuoka into like on the steel part of the turnbuckle at one point. That was nasty.
The only other person I've seen do that was Buzz Sawyer. He did it to Mike Scott, who was a prelim guy in WCW on one of the 1989 shows. Now, Mike Scott was around about 110 pounds wet through. You know, he was a really slim guy, and you can imagine, but he was really tall. So you can imagine when he doubled himself over on the turnbuckle, it was like the most horrific thing I'd seen in a wrestling match up until that point. And then Buzz Sawyer, he was another advocate of the double foot stomp. Oh, no, that's Kevin Sullivan, wasn't it? But yeah, Buzz Sawyer, like, you know, kills this guy. And this is the first time I'd seen it since then. And it was like, yeah, it's so brutal. It's such a brutal move to do to somebody. And it got to hurt. It can't not do.
Yeah. And classic Joshi matches, certainly, there's usually about three or four of those types of spots per match. And then, yeah, you almost forget how much crazy stuff they do, because they do so much.
Didn't Masami... Yeah, sorry, Karen.
No, go, you go.
I was going to say, Masami, like, press-slammed Fukuoka over the top rope onto Hasegawa floor.
An 8-minute match, I think, as well. So, and they were going at some pace, and, like, lots of dives and big high impact moves off the top rope and brawling on the outside and stuff like that. I was saying the creativity and risk taking again, this is where I was saying, like, this is so ahead of its time, like stuff where I can't remember which way around it was, but one of them did a moonsault off the other's shoulders.
That was Fukuoka off Hasegawa.
Yes, that was insane. Like, just things like that that, you know, weren't happening in North American wrestling at the time. And here it was just, like I say, there were about five of those spots in this match alone. Also, it was interesting watching it from kind of a perspective of like classic babyface heel dynamics, because certainly for like a Western audience, if you like trying to understand the dynamics and stuff like that, because Devil and Bull were great. great tag team name, Devil and Bull. But they're obviously working sort of the bigger bad guys, but then Fukuoka and Hasegawa aren't doing classic babyface things. They're, you know, they're the smaller wrestlers, they're showing loads of fire and making, you know, they're taking the heat and making the comebacks and stuff like that, but they also attack them before the bell, they're fighting them on the outside. Fukuoka kicks the ref at one point to stop a count. It's really interesting when you look back with kind of more of a, I guess, more of an American style eye, if that makes sense, in terms of how they would do heel babyface dynamics and be like, they're doing it, but they're doing it in a very different way, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, to me it is just like, they're just really, really aggressive. They're not heels. I never saw Hasegawa as a heel. She, like, you look at the way she, what she wears, she's just a really intense baby face. And Fukuoka's kind of the same. So yeah, it is interesting to me to see how they develop. And they must have had some time to practice together, because they're pulling off double team moves that are quite complicated. This isn't just like the double clothesline, double backdrop stuff you see irregular tag teams do all the time. This is quite complex double teamwork. This is something they would have actually had to time some time to do. You know, to, you know, go with a woman who you don't regularly work with and trust her to let you stand on her shoulders, or alternatively stand on their shoulders and expect her to carry your weight whilst you do a moonsault.
Yes.
That's some guts there to do that. You know, that's interesting. That's amazing that they got the time to practice considering the schedules they were on.
But it's the same with Devil and Bull. Like, they were working well as a tag team as well. And you were saying this is probably the first time they'd ever tagged together. I know they knew each other very well from working together as opponents and stuff like that. But yeah, there was a lot of stuff of like tandem offense, and they kind of, the little story running through was they kept both trying to hit leg drops from the top, and then that was, you know, they kept missing, and then the end, that was the finish, that they both managed to hit it and kill them, basically.
Yeah, it was a good piece of, solid piece of work and strong storytelling. It's also early in the tape when you're watching it as well, so it does feel slightly out of place, because it goes long, and you kind of expect it to be shorter because it's supposed to be an opening tag match on the tape. But I think that's something they could have picked up on their editing a little bit. This card, I think if this card was in order, it'd be a lot better paced, and I'd probably feel, I don't dislike this card, but I think I'd rave about it a lot more if I'd actually watched it in order.
I kind of tried to chop and change and watch it in the order it was intended, and I think, because, you know, this is a 28 minute tag match, like, it's not an opening match. I mean, it's got Bull Nakano in, for God's sake, of course it's not an opening match. But it's, yeah, like you say, it's strange the way the video's been cut together, but there you go.
We'll move on then to the next match, which is bang in the middle of the tape, which is Chigusa Nagayo of the Crush Girls, the living legend of Joshi, who was just in the midst of her comeback. She'd got off AJW commentary and started as a freelancer in 1993. She'd had some matches for AJW, notably against Bull Nakano and Devil Masami at Dream Slam 1 and Dream Slam 2. And here she makes her JWP debut as a JWP wrestler. She was announced as a JWP wrestler against Mayumi Ozaki. Now, within the year, she would have founded Gaia Pro Wrestling. So this is where she's really feeling out her style and what's going to match her audience for her new company. And the other companies are giving her an opportunity to do that, which you kind of like have to think that's really interesting and strange that the other companies do, but it became the blueprint for the way Joshi works. Joshi is a collective of all the companies, and generally they get on politically, and generally they pro-promote all together all the time, you know. So this was kind of like the start of that process. As the bigger companies broke down, they spread the work out to give each other more opportunities to make money with different angles and different styles. So Chigusa Nagayo comes into this match in the classic Chigusa Nagayo way. She comes and checks out her opponent at Currican Hall, sat there in her racer jacket with her Dallas Cowboys cap on, head down, concentrating what she's doing and minding her own business. But that never works out for her, does it, Alex?
No, it doesn't. Particularly not when Ozaki's involved, anyway.
No, she's tried the same thing with Megumi Mikudo and Aja Kong. Didn't work out for her then, there in FMW either. I don't know why she bothers going to Currican Hall. Yeah.
Just watch it from home, to be honest.
Then she went to a Stardom show and picked a fight 3 or 4 years ago. And then she had to go and start Marvelous because she had a fight with Mako Satomura at a Sendai Girls show at Currican Hall. Just stay home, Chigusa. It'll all be all right. You can stay retired then. People make you do stuff when you go to Currican Hall. Anyway. Chigusa Nagayo versus Mayumi Ozaki. Now, Mayumi Ozaki, we've talked a lot about before. Her tag team with Dynamite Kansai is arguably one of the greatest tag teams of all time, and certainly her feud with Dynamite Kansai against Manami Toyota and Toshiya Yamada, I believe, is the greatest tag feud of all time and produced the greatest wrestling matches of all time. But that's my just personal opinion. Not everyone agrees with me. However, she was an absolutely stunning heel. She was a really big star for JWP. She was their best technical wrestler, but she loved brawling just as much as she loved wrestling. And this match was a prime example of that. Chigusa Nagayo comes out in this Roman cape with big shoulder pads kind of deal.
That was so good as well.
It's so cool. It's like the coolest thing ever.
And then she's just stood in the ring like, yep, this is happening.
I am Nero. Come see my great shoulder pads. And then Mayumi Ozaki, in her usual style, comes out dressed wearing a boudoir like dressing gown kind of deal with boa feathers and red tassels everywhere for the most aggressive pro wrestler you've ever seen in your life. And it essentially break after a stare down and a steady walk around, it breaks down into the brawl and they're both bleeding within 5 minutes. Alex, what did you think of this match?
Oh, it's so good. It's so brutal and it's such a great brawl. It's funny, you just mentioned there, like their gear and stuff. It's interesting because I think, like, if you didn't know sort of the history and the background, I think it would be fascinating to outside viewers, like if they don't know the history of the Crush Girls and stuff like that, and who Nagayo is. Because if you look at them, you would almost think, well, she's the bad guy and Ozaki's the good guy.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, because of the way she comes out and the way she's dressed. But within like a minute, you know that is not the case, the way they work the match. Like, Ozaki's just awful to her. Like, she's just so, like, just so brutal and so bloodthirsty. And it's like, not necessarily what an outside viewer would expect looking at their looks and stuff like that. Sorry, I just clicked off something there. The blood, like by the end, Ozaki's face, like, is just, she's just covered. It's obviously Nagayo gets busted open first with Ozaki hitting her with whatever it was. I thought it was a screwdriver initially.
Yes, it was a screwdriver, and then it was a bit of pipe.
Yeah, it was just whatever she could get her hands on, basically, wasn't it? So, obviously, when she got busted open a bit later, it was the payback for that. I think she got busted open after a pile driver on the floor. Something like, they were just brawling all over the place, getting on the mic and taunting each other. The main thing, besides how good the match was, I was watching it going, some wrestlers nowadays need to watch this and just realize this is how you do a match when you hate each other. Like, there was no, you weren't thinking these guys were, you know, mates when they went through the curtains. Like, you really got the sense that these two were like proper, this was like a blood feud, right? It was really, they really despised each other was the idea. And the way they worked the match, they just, you know, they went for each other from the opening bell. They were attacking each other all over the place. They were talking trash to one another, which I would have I wish I could speak Japanese and knew what they were taunting each other with and stuff like that. Yeah, I just thought the whole thing was great. You had, you know, the last 5 minutes, the closing stretch is unbelievable in terms of the drama, because you've got the blood involved as well. And they were just doing crazy dives and counters and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, it was great, I thought, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it was I think this was the Ozaki these days, and certainly for the last 10 years, has been the master brawler of Oz Academy. She's the lead booker for Oz Academy, which was a company that was started off as a faction in Gaia, as the heel faction of Gaia. And, you know, so clearly Nagayo and Ozaki couldn't have not hated each other that much to work together for about 10 years.
Yeah, so I didn't mean that they actually hated each other. No, what I mean
the
is
idea
came
is
across like that, yeah, in the ring, like, which is, that's the skill, because I'm sure they got on very well outside the ring, but you wouldn't have known it from this match.
Yeah, because Ozaki becomes like Ozaki becomes Nagayo's main protagonist for the next 10 years when she forms Gaia, and Ozaki leaves JWP for Gaia. So, you know, that's this was the genesis of a 10-year story, which technically, I suppose, if Marvelous end up co-promoting with Oz Academy, which I think they have done, will carry on for another 10 years afterwards. You know, this is... And it really shows the start of when Nagayo changes from this super technical wrestler with elements of brawling to this brawler with elements of science that she becomes in Gaia. This is the start of the Gaia style, which is the basis for everything Miko Satomura's done, a lot of things for what Kato's done in Oz Academy as well. You know, this is kind of this genesis of this new style that Nagayo is going to found when she starts Gaia in a couple of years, well, less than a year's time. So I find this match really interesting from an historical point of view, as well as the fact like Ozaki is coming across as queen heel. She's this brawling style that she develops, that she then takes to FMW to feud with Megumi Kudo, and she brings back to JWP, and then takes off to Gaia to feud with Nagayo again for the next 10 years. It's really interesting to me how she's developing here, getting away from the science and giving us something that's going to have more longevity, because when you throw in clotheslines and using weapons and using factions, that means your career can last a lot longer than being a big bump scientific wrestler.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's such a great character in this match as well. Like, she's genuinely quite terrifying watching it, because you have that idea of like, I don't know what she's going to do next, like, to hurt this person, you know.
I absolutely love when she was on the Shikara Joshi Mania tour, Garavin loudspeaker announced her as coming to you from Tokyo, Japan, where she runs the Oz Academy gym, where she teaches her students all the dirty tricks in the book. It's Mayumi Ozaki.
Spot on.
So it's a lot of fun to watch this match, and it's dead serious wrestling. There's loads of stuff going on from the story point of view. Highly recommended, would you not say so, sir?
Yes, I really, really enjoyed this. From like you say, it was the genesis of a feud, and then there was a lot of that on this card. We're going to talk about the main event now, which was again also sort of a big feud at the time. So these are two examples of, you know, big feuds that would go on for a few years.
Yes, and we should get to the next match, which is Aja Kong versus Dynamite Kansai. Now, this particular match was set up in All Japan Women, where Aja managed to lay the spinning back fist onto Dynamite and knock her out. And then she did it again in the next match they had at JWP. This was the story of these two wrestlers. Could Kansai avoid getting taken out by the spinning back fist and take the championship for JWP, which would be a first that someone not from AJW was the WWWA Women's Champion? This was a cleverly told story, and it had a lot at stake, and it was a lot at stake for the company. You notice on this card, the JWP Openweight Championship is not up for discussion. There are no JWP titles on the line in this particular card. So this is kind of like putting AJW above JWP knowingly to show how important that company is against their stars. And this was an absolutely stunning match to represent that story really, really well. What did you think of this, Alex?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, they told that story really well. I think even if you don't know the background or anything like that, which, like you say, it was good that they had the little promo packages, which introduced you to that. But I think even going in cold, you would get, you know, the story is she wants to avoid that spinning back fist. And they told that really well throughout. I always think that for people who haven't seen a lot of Joshi and don't really understand, you should watch Aja Kong's matches to sort of get you in, because she's very much a classic big heel. And in this match, it was very much more what you would expect from a wrestling match, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
in terms
yeah.
of Aja Kong is the heel. She is beating down the babyface. The babyface is having to fight back and try and survive and things like that and fire up. I mean, the moment near down the stretch, and again, the closing stretch of this is amazing, where they just start basically hitting each other relentlessly, and it turns into basically more of an MMA boxing style thing where there's knockdowns and the ref's counting and they're getting back to their feet. But there's a moment where Aja Kong knocks her down with the back fist, and Kansai just gets up and runs at her and forearms her so hard, and the crowd are just going nuts. Like, it was just so well done. Which, like I say, is built on the fact that she's been beaten down for a lot of the match, which is very, very classic. So yeah, if you're a Joshi beginner, I think this is a great place to start. And it's, you know, this is part of a feud, like you say, that's gone between both companies. And you mentioned the Big Egg Universe card, where they had possibly their best match on that card. So
yeah,
this will, you know, this then went to, I mean, that's one of the biggest cards ever, if not the biggest card ever. So yeah, the feud obviously carried on into that and was one of the biggest things in Japanese wrestling at the time. I think this is a great example of why, like I say, that closing stretch, I was just like, this is unbelievable. Like, they've got the crowd in the palm of their hands.
Yeah, undoubtedly, you know, it's some of the best storytelling you'll see in Joshi. You know, I've seen better matches, but I haven't seen stories as well told as this, if you see what I mean. Mm. From a technical point of view, from like, you know, pure classic technical wrestling match, if you want a pure classic technical wrestling match, go watch Minami Toyota versus Akira Hokuto. This isn't that, but it's just as good in a different way. You know, they can't do the things that those two women can do, but they can do other things so well and explain their story, and you are so empathetic to Kansai, you know, especially with the video package before. They're sat in the Ariki Arena, which is where this card was held, and it's empty, and it's a 10,000 seat stadium, and clearly she's kind of like talking about her story with JWP and where the company's come from, and the company's only been around for 4 years and they're filling 10,000 seat stadiums. And, you know, that's how important it is to her, how important it is to the company to take the WWWA championship. It has all this lineage that goes back to Jackie Yokota and Mildred Burke. All of these things wrap up into this story that is all about survival for Dynamite Kansai. If she can stay away from the spinning back fist, she stands a chance, because she's never landed Big Splash Mountain, which is her finisher, a sit-out Razor's Edge, if you haven't seen her before. So if she can land her finisher, she has a chance, but she's got to stay away from Kong long enough to get that finisher on her. And she doesn't actually manage it in the match, which is another element into the story which carries on, because this feud goes on for another year and a half until Kansai eventually wins the AJW championship, or WWWA championship. So this is kind of such a turning point in the story of Joshi, going from just being AJW by itself to all these companies working together for the better of the industry.
Mm. And like you say, it's a classic wrestling thing of, this is the chase. Like, the thrill's in the chase, as they say, the money's in the chase. And it is Kansai's chasing that belt for, like you say, a year and a half, just based on she needs to avoid this finisher, basically. And she does for a lot of this match, and then the end gets knocked out by it. And it's brutal again, very brutal. I mean, I'm always reminded when I watch Aja Kong, like, how brutal her work was and is. Like, it's no surprise that her and Minoru Suzuki are basically best mates, is it? When you watch, like, that is a violent friendship, I imagine.
Or a friendship of violent people. I don't think either of them are
yes.
violent.
Well, I don't know. They've wrestled before, haven't they? And very yes. much seem to enjoy beating the crap out of one another, I think. But yeah.
In JWP, funnily enough.
Yes, it was. Yeah, full circle.
Indeed. We have come back to full circle. And Minoru Suzuki, who is in the country this weekend. He's in the UK for the Rev Pro shows. And speaking of which, Aja Kong will be in this country in May when she debuts for Pro Wrestling Eve at the York Hall, which will be a big opportunity for her as she wrestles Viper to bring her brand of violence to the UK for the first time. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yes, I would quite like to come to that if I can. Get money together, because yeah, that is a great matchup.
And we will tag Pro Wrestling Eve into this so you can find the details of what that show is and where it will be, and how much it will cost and all the other details. But all roads lead to Bethnal Green for Aja Kong. So Alex, this is your first experience with JWP. What did you think of this particular card and where the company at is in 1994?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen little bits here and there of JWP, but I've never really sat down and watched something resembling a full card from what we could get from the video. yeah, I mean, it just very much shows why Joshi Wrestling was so hot at the time. You know, like we talked about, these were certainly the main event and the co-main event were big feuds that were going to carry on for years down the line. I really enjoyed it, I think. You can see why they got so close to AJW on the basis of shows like this. It's a shame they could never quite push them as much as perhaps they would have wanted, and it probably would have made the Joshi even stronger as a result, because like you say, it was extra places for people to work and it was an absolute boom period. So yeah, I very much enjoyed this card.
Yes, and I would strongly recommend this card for you too. It's something that's a bit different to what we've looked at before on the Trupini show, and it's well worth taking a look at a different angle on Joshi and a different place for Japanese women's wrestling. And we will probably come back to JWP in a couple of episodes' time, but we're definitely going to be talking about them when it comes to Big Egg Universe, because they were a big presence on that card, which was a co-promoted card with AJW, LLPW, FMW, and the WWF, as it was at the time.
I think that's, again, an interesting part of the story of how big it was at the time. I think it's, you know, I hadn't seen this card before. I've seen Big Egg Wrestling Universe before, and I'm very much looking forward to watching it again before we talk about it. So, yeah, I think this is kind of a great precursor to what happens on that show in terms of the talent involved, the stories they were telling, and this great period in Japanese wrestling.
We probably won't look at all 18 matches and 11 hours of the show, mind. Hope we won't disappoint you, but, you know, watching...
We'll just watch the classic matches, so that's just about, what, 10 of them?
Yeah.
10 of them?
Yeah, the two amateur exhibitions we might leave out, though they are worth talking about for what they are.
Yeah.
right then. We'd like to thank you for listening to the Trupini show today. We appreciate your patronage. And speaking of which, please go look at our Patreon page and please pledge to support us so that we can keep the Trupini show free forever for everyone. I would also like to thank my guest today, Mr. Alex Watt. Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Hopefully my ramblings made sense through my hungover haze.
You were fine, sir. Don't worry. We can let you get back to bed now.
It helps when the card's this good, to be fair.
It does make you want to talk about it. You can find him at AlexWatt187 on Twitter. You can find me at Sheriff Lone Star on Twitter as well. And you can find the show at Trupini Show on Twitter. You can find us on a Facebook as well if you search Trupini Show, as well as Patreon, like we mentioned. We'll be back next week. Until then, take care and speak to you soon. Bye.